Okay, we'll make a start. Hope everyone's enjoying this nice cold morning. It's okay, it's warming up a little bit. When I went to shul this morning at 6 o'clock, it was really cold. All right, so last week was great. It was lots of fun. Thank you for all those that came and got the books and so on. Just a quick review on 2 weeks ago. We talked about freedom and responsibility, that amazing lecture that Viktor Frankl gave on what freedom means, what responsibility means, and its link to meaning. When you take responsibility and you own your own story, that's when we understand that we have to give every moment and every experience meaning. And he talked about the concept of responsibility, and that is, freedom. Freedom is not about doing what we want, but it's about doing what is right. Okay, so today we're going to do one more thing. We're still going to go for another two Thursdays until the end of the term. Then we'll take a break for 2 weeks. But I think we might end the topic today, and the next 2 weeks will be one-off topics, which I'll put on the broadcast and on the messages and so on. But we'll go for another 2 weeks, and in 2 weeks' time, on the last one, we'll also draw the raffle, which is going. So we'll draw it. We sometimes do it at the Thursday morning in class. So we'll do it. Just before we start, I want to share with you something nice. It's been we'll talk about it a bit as we go along, but it's been an unbelievable week. The different WhatsApps go around with different stories. We're just such a beautiful nation. So there's a bakery in Israel, in central Israel, where the siren went off. I don't know if you saw this, but just close to closing time. And everyone had to run to safety, as they do. And then when the siren was over, they just went home because it was the end of the workday. They thought they locked up, but actually they didn't. And it was really after closing time. So the next day, the bakery was literally open, but they actually decided not to open up because they decided, it's been a hectic few days, let's take a day off. But they hadn't locked the door. So people from the neighborhood came by the next day for food, and the door was open, but there was no workers. But they were hungry, and they wanted food. So a whole bunch of people took food, and they took whatever they took, the products, and they wrote down on a napkin. Each person wrote down on a napkin their name and their phone number, and left it there. And when the owners came the next day, they were really stunned that they'd forgotten to lock up, and that the napkins, what all the names on the napkins, exactly matched up everything that was missing from the bakery. So we're a beautiful family. Not to say that Israel aren't criminals, there aren't people in jail for stealing. It's a nation, it's a people like all people, and there's plenty of prisoners there too, but what there isn't in other places, as there is in Israel, is that incredible sense of community and oneness, with all the squabbling and all the fighting and all that, but it's really, we are one family, brothers and sisters, who fight with each other, but also come together when we need to. All right, so today I want to focus on the last chapter of the book that I was basing the series on, this book called Embracing Hope. It's a book by Viktor Frankl. It's four different interviews or lectures that he gave, and also some interviews on YouTube and so on. But the last one is called Meaning and Responsibility in the Face of Transience, which we'll talk about in a minute. And in this chapter, he makes a few different points connected to living a life of meaning. And I want to share them, but I also want to sort of go a bit deeper within them. And also a little bit try and connect it with what's going on now as well. Before I do that, I just want to share with you another interesting thing that's also been making its rounds on WhatsApps. Today in the Jewish calendar is actually an interesting day. But this year, and it's every year it comes up, it's a special day, which I'll explain in a moment. But this year it has particular relevance. So it's a special day because of something that says in the book of Esther. So today is the 23rd of the month of Sivan, right? And in the Megillah, I think I've shared this with you before. I'd explained it that Purim obviously is still months away. But the story of Purim actually began around Pesach time when Haman made this, got Ahasuerus to make this decree to kill the Jewish people, that it was one designated day, which was going to be like 11 and a half months away in the month of Adar, which is around Purim time, the day after Purim actually. And eventually the Jews sprung into action. They fasted, they reconnected. That was around Pesach time. Then they had the whole thing with the parties and they got Ahasuerus to come around. And miraculously, Ahasuerus was very angry at Haman. He hung Haman and then got to work with the following, because the problem was that under Persian law, they couldn't rescind the decree that was signed by the king, but they could issue another decree. And the decree was that the Jews could fight back. They could mobilize, they could militarize, they can fight back, and they could destroy the enemies. To use the words of the Megillah, Liyot hayudim atidim, that the Jews on that designated day could take revenge from the enemies and destroy the enemies. And it was on the 23rd of Sivan, today, that the edict went out to all the Jews in all 127 provinces. The runners went, it says, and they delivered this law from the king that the Jews could mobilize and they could fight back. They could kill all those that threatened them, and they could take revenge from the enemies that had wanted to destroy them. Now, of course, the Purim story is in Iran, right? Yeah. It takes place in Iran. Yeah. So it's just an interesting timing of this whole thing. Just before I do fall into the trap of checking the news every so often, and apparently there's strikes again in Iran which are stronger than one before. So the promise of the Megillah is coming true, and I think it's going to be amazing. And the Jews are courageous and doing amazing things. But we'll come back to the Mirz Hashem. Okay. So back to the topic. So just by introduction, Viktor Frankl and his theories, right? We've talked about this many times. We've mentioned this many times, that they are very much in line with Judaism and Jewish thoughts and Jewish values, right? However, it's important to understand that when we look at them, we need to look at them a little bit deeper, because while these theories are in line with Judaism and Jewish thinking and Jewish values, they aren't Jewish wisdom itself, meaning they're not Torah, right? Just a simple example. So when he talks about meaning and the different forms of meaning, that's all good. But of course, for us, when we look at it in a Jewish perspective, we have a primary source of meaning and values, which is, of course, our Torah that we received 3,337 years ago. And we have a unique role and a unique mission. So I think it's important when we look at this, and I want to do that today, particularly with some of the thoughts he's mentioning today, that we don't only take the ideas that Viktor Frankl talks about, but as Jews, we also look at it a little bit deeper, knowing that it's in line with Jewish wisdom, and we want to deepen our connection with our Jewish soul and our Judaism, especially now, during this time, since October 7th, really, there's been that awakening, and especially now this week, connecting, and that should be happening, that we should connect stronger with pride and conviction to our Jewishness and our Jewish connection. We need to take these ideas and look at them sort of through a Jewish lens and go deeper. Because what we'll see is that when we look at it from a Jewish perspective, from a Torah perspective, they become deeper, they become richer actually, and they become more relevant. Living our life not just with meaning, but with Jewish meaning. In other words, real Judaism. It's not to negate what he says at all. What he says is fantastic. It's just trying to look at it from a deeper, smaller lens in a way, not smaller, bigger lens in a way, through Jewish thoughts. Okay. So one of the things he does in this, it's actually a lecture, chapter 4, it's a lecture that he gave, I'm not sure where. And initially he makes a point, which we've discussed briefly, but he kind of sort of takes it a bit differently, and it's worth exploring even more. I'll read you a little bit. He says like this: I would just like to begin by confirming that the topic of my lecture is not conquering the past, but conquering transience. Now, what's very interesting is he makes this very big distinction between the past and transience. Something that's transient is here and then not here. The past is still here. That's one of his points he makes. And when we look at it again from a Jewish perspective, we'll see how deep that is. And he says, the question is, how a person can manage the transience of human existence, the transience of life, i.e. how can he cope with the fact and deal with the knowledge that human life is essentially impermanent. Or more specifically, how an individual can get to a place where he can, when he can say yes to life in spite of its transience. How he can affirm his life in spite of his own mortality. Right? So this is the question, the foundational question of the chapter. Now, the fact that he says the world is transient, of course, that's true. True on different levels. Everything physical is transient. We know when God created the world, God is infinite, of course, but the world is transient because the world is physical. Physical meaning it's finite. It's finite both in space and in time. And we read in the Pesukim in the verses of Tanakh, and it's explained at great length in Kabbalah and so on, that even in the world itself, specifically, we have what's called Tzva HaShamayim and Tzva HaAretz, which means the hosts, the creatures of heaven, or the creations of heaven and the creations of earth. The creations of heaven are things like the sun, the moon, the stars, the planets, and so on. And those, I'll just use the Kabbalistic terminology, are Kayamin Be'ish, which means they actually are more permanent. When God created the world, and he doesn't have to make it permanent, he's in full control, but he wanted things like the planets, like the sun, like the moons, the galaxies, and so on, to be there always. It doesn't mean they're truly infinite, but it means by his will, they remain as he recreates them all the time. However, when it comes to Tzva HaAretz, when it comes to the creations of earth, they're also permanent to a certain extent. So, for example, the human race is permanent, but not each individual. So we have children and we procreate and the human race continues, as do various animals, various trees, and so on and so forth, but not in themselves. The idea continues, but not the thing. There was a 12th or 13th century sage who was also the author of the Shor HaBitachon. It's called Rabbeinu Bahaya, and he says, he has this line when he says, Haktinok, the baby, from the moment that he's born, or she's born, begins to wither. In other words, yeah. Right? So, from when we're born, we start to...
die.
Well, something like that, yeah. Hopefully, after a very long time, but that's what happens, right? Because we're essentially finite. Okay. So he continues and he says, this is not a bad thing, as we'll soon see in a second. He says, so in the face of death, life needs to be managed. That's the point, right? Because really death begins when a person's born. You could say that a life of a human being, he says, it's a bit morbid this, but he says you can say that a life of a human being is a constant farewell, right? And the fundamental question is whether this transience, this mortality, works retroactively and makes life not worth living, devalues it or makes it meaningless, robbing it of all meaning. So that's the first question that we need to ask ourselves. I would like to start with the assumption that death is not only unable to take away life's meaning, it actually gives life meaning. It gives life meaning. Right? So what he's gonna make the point is that the transience actually gives life its meaning. Now, how do we work with that? So on a very basic level, he does a couple of points. The first point he makes is the following. That actually the transience of this world and the transience of life in particular gives us actually a sense of urgency, right? Which is created by the limited time that we have here. And this is, Tehillim has a lot about this, and in Tanakh we talk about Yamam Yitzara, that a person has a certain amount of life and we have to treasure it and we have to make it meaningful and so on. But he makes an interesting point. He says the following. He says, and we're going to take it on a deeper level in a moment, but he says the following. He says, just imagine what would happen, what life would look like if there was no death. Imagine what it would be like if you could postpone anything and everything, right? If you could put it off for eternity, you wouldn't have to do anything today or tomorrow. Everything could just be as easily be done next week, next month, next year, in a decade or 100 or 1,000 years from now. Only in the face of our mortality can... Only under the pressure from the finiteness is there any point in going about our business. And not only in going about our business, but in experiencing life. And not only experiencing life, but also in loving someone and even in bravely enduring and surviving something that is being inflicted on us, right? Because we don't have time to waste. We don't have time to put off things, right? So that's a very basic point that he's making, which we'll come back to in a minute. And then the second point he makes is this. I spoke earlier, he says, about the opportunity to fulfill a meaning. And remember, the meaning he says on many levels, like it could be experiencing something or loving someone, religion, belief, and so on. They must be noticed, they must be actualized and achieved. So, right, this is his point. So meaning means you live a life of meaning, but meaning actually means an experience, an action, right? He's very big on this idea. And that is the task of every human being in every single situation in life. For when a possibility for meaning has been fulfilled, and once we have transformed such a potentiality into a reality, and I mean once, even if it's once, in other words, and we have done it once and for all, it remains and no one can undo it and no one can cancel it out. It's very beautiful language. Yes, we have rescued it into the past. There it is safeguarded precisely from transience, right? Once we've done something, it's done. Now, we talked a few weeks ago on a spiritual level, let's see more, when you do something good or meaningful, we learn in Jewish wisdom that it actually is eternal, not only because it's been done, but actually its spiritual effect is way beyond our life, its spiritual influence. And it connects to a God who is transcendent, who transcends time and space, and therefore it is always there. It's become something nitzchi, it's become something absolutely eternal, right? But only the possibilities need to be fulfilled, he says. Only they are transitory. In other words, the possibilities are transitory. But when we have actualized one of these possibilities, we have made it everlasting. We have not just actualized it, we have made it eternal. In the past, nothing is irretrievably lost, as people often believe, but rather the opposite. It is captured and saved. It is preserved there and is protected from, and this is our topic, the grasp of transience. Okay. So let's explore this a little bit. First of all, let's talk about the meaningfulness of life, or is it the significance of life, and especially a transient life. So I want to shift to an idea that's talked about in Hasidic philosophy and in Kabbalah and so on. I'll use the Hebrew and I'll explain it, called Bitul Ha'olamot. Basically, especially in the book of Tanya, it talks about this a lot. When you look at the world as an independent thing, when you look at the world as an independent creation, it is actually completely insignificant, right? It's truly transient, it means nothing, and it's actually empty. There's a concept coming from the Zohar that says, Kulei kamei kalo chashiv. Anything in the face of God is like nothing, right? I'll give you a little bit of an analogy, just to go on a Hasidic philosophy path for a minute. When you have something extremely great, even in the physical world, if you have a king sitting on the throne room, and there's a tiny, tiny fly or tiny insect sort of crawling in the corner of the room, in the insect's world, the insect might think it's great, but it's insignificant. It's not even noticed. In the face of God, God who is truly infinite, God who is the truly true source of creation, and as the Tanya explains, that actually is not only the true source of creation, but the world cannot exist without God continuously recreating it. In other words, it has a very flimsy existence. So the world in itself, don't worry, we're going to get a bit more hopeful in a minute, the world itself is actually like emptiness. And therefore worldliness, pursuit of materialism for its own sake, pursuit of pleasure and worldly pleasures, right, are really, if we think about it properly, we might think it's significant. We might think some of the achievements and fame and material achievements and accomplishments and so on are unbelievable accomplishments. They are in our world, but in the big scheme of things, in the true world, in the world of God, in the world of the true truth, in other words, they're nothing. They're insignificant. Not only because they're transient, because they're truly insignificant, right? And therefore, if you live a life like that, the life becomes meaningless. Many, many years ago, we did a Thursday morning series on Stephen Covey's 7 Habits. And if you remember. And one of the things he says, begin with the end in mind. Right? So you have to always start, what's your goal? What's your mission? And one of the strategies that he suggests is, after many, many, many years, write your own eulogy. not literally, but he says, think about what you'd like people to say about you. What do they want to say? That you ate lots of sushi? I mean, he doesn't say that. I'm thinking that, right? We ate lots of pizza. We ate Chinese food a lot. I mean, what? Right? We had 7 cars. Like, what do you want people to say about us, right? So when we talk about those material pursuits, especially the way I did it very briefly, but if you learn Hasidic philosophy in greater depth, you see and explains it from so many different angles, how they truly mean nothing. They mean something in our perspective. I'm going to give you a little bit of an analogy. There's a famous Hasidic analogy that Hasidim would use. It's not the normal kind of thing we should normally share a proper formal class, but it's normally at a Fabrinian after a couple of the chaims. This is the kind of analogies that Hasidim would share. So you'll excuse me, but it's just, it's a very powerful analogy. An analogy is a story of a shtetl. Things getting a bit hot in here, isn't it? No?
Just
okay. No problem. I'll do this then. Okay, when I get a call, I'll put it back on. So it's a story of a shtetl. It's a very silly story, but it's a very powerful story. It's a story of a shtetl where there was a poor family who had to, their budget was very, very limited. And you know, in those days, to get water, you had to go and draw it, and they couldn't afford a water carrier, so they had to do it themselves, and so on and so forth. So they had to save. And they owned a cow. And of course, the cow would have to be given water. It's one of the things that water was necessary, not only for themselves, but for the cow to drink. So they decided, how are you going to save a bit of water? They decided that after Shabbos, they ate very little during the week. Because only Shabbos, they had like fish and meat. They saved to have a nice Shabbat meal and so on. And after Shabbos, they had to wash the dishes in some sort of tub with water. And of course, in that tub of water was all, you know, the leftover cholent and the gefilte fish and who knows what. They decided, rather than throw the water away, every Motzei Shabbos, every time Shabbos comes out, they'll give that tub to the cow to drink. The cow starts to get this tub of water, which is essentially all the junk from Shabbos, right? And the cow thinks it's wonderful. Like, wow, flavored water, right? And the cow starts to really enjoy. He waits a whole week for this tub, for this beautiful treat that he gets every Matzah Shabbos with all the stuff that we would consider complete rubbish, waste. One day, one Matzah Shabbos, the story goes, something happened and someone tripped over the tub and it was all spilled out, so they couldn't give that tub of water to the cow. So they gave a tub of fresh water to the cow. The cow tastes the water and says and thinks to himself, where's my Motzei Shabbos treat? So the story goes that the cow thought to himself, he says, it must be that all the humans were jealous of me. And therefore they're jealous. How come the cow gets this treat every week? So therefore they decided they're going to not do it this week, or maybe they'll give it to someone else. But they'll have to balance out and work and navigate the jealousy. And that's why I didn't get my treat this week. So the Hasidim would tell the story, and I say, I kind of bring when they want to sort of push each other a little bit and drive each other and inspire each other to be more meaningful and leave themselves in their own world a little bit. They used to say, you know, we all have an animal, we all have a cow within ourselves, right? And when we pursue stuff that is meaningless and empty and it's just pleasurable and pleasurable pursuit, then that's how it becomes a whole obsession of how much we can get and how much we can achieve in the pleasure sphere and how much we can derive pleasure, and that's all we think about. We're like the cow who thinks it's amazing. And who thinks that when we... Children have small toys and adults have very, very big toys and all this kind of stuff. So we like the cow who thinks it's unbelievably amazing because they don't live in the world of the human beings who know that that tub of water is rubbish. It's junk, right? So everything's perfect. So the world, if you just look at the world in a independent sense, the world is an empty place. It's transient, it's meaningless, it's empty. And some of the stuff that we get involved in or worry about and obsess with is part of that world, so it becomes an empty sort of existence. However, when we take this world that God created, right, this is what we are taught in the works of Chassidut. The world itself is not really a true existence. It's flimsy and it's empty and it has no independence, really. But when we use the world for meaning and purpose, right, and when we use the world to connect to God, to connect, to make, first of all, ourselves, to connect to God ourselves, or to make the world godly, right? In Hasidut, there's a very, very fundamental principle that the purpose of creation is based on a midrash which says that God desired, He created the world. It's an interesting question. Why did God create the world? So one of the ideas is that God created the world because He wanted to come and live in a place where He's not obvious. In the higher worlds and the upper worlds, God is obvious. But in this world, He created a world where is a world of darkness, a world of apparent emptiness, a world which sometimes looks like a complete jungle, looks like a very ungodly and feels like a very ungodly place. It's a place where the beings and the creations of God in this world do not have the consciousness that they really are godly creations. And then we reveal that and we bring God and we invite God, so to speak, to live in this world. We make the world godly. Suddenly the world becomes a different place. It's no longer an empty existence. It's no longer transient in that sense. It's no longer non-significant. It takes on a whole new depth and significance. It becomes a real place, an eternal place. It becomes the place of God. It becomes a place of meaning, and it becomes eternal. That very existence that was empty, the very existence that we look at as insignificant and transient, becomes an eternal, infinite place of God. That's what we are taught in Jewish wisdom, right? So therefore, it gives a whole new depth to that concept. So he puts it in the sense where transience becomes the past. In other words, if you take something that's potential and you give it meaning, and then you now have created something that's eternal, but actually it's much deeper than that. Not just that it's in the past or it's eternal, you've given the whole world a new significance. It's now no longer a place that is just empty and flimsy. We've taken that out of the world of the cow, basically. It's become a real place. It's become a place which is a true and eternal place because it's filled with meaning and it's become a godly world, not just a world. The same world. So when you take a physical thing, and that's why Judaism, for example, is so busy with the physicality of the world. On the one hand, we look at the physical world and we say, this is nothing. What's this world? And then all the mitzvot and all the things that we're supposed to do are all got to do with physicality. Right? It's the Shabbos candle that we have to light on Friday night. It's the tefillin we put on our arms. Physical tefillin. It comes from an animal we put on our physical arm. We give money to poor. We give tzedakah. We everything. We eat in the sukkah. We eat on Pesach. It's a mitzvah to eat matzah. We make a blessing before we eat. All the things, kashrut, everything. Most of the laws, 95% of the laws of 99% probably, of the laws of Judaism are all about, they're not even about spirituality. Yes, the spirituality is the intent that we have to have and the passion and the preparation, but the actual mitzvah is physical, right? It's an interesting thing in Judaism. I mean, we always think about prayer being a very integral part of Judaism, and it is. It's very powerful, and it's very real. Learning Torah is a very thing. Jewish meditation is a very important thing. But actually, it's a fraction of what Judaism is. It's almost like a means to an end. Someone can meditate on Shabbat candles a whole week and can connect to the spirituality of the Shabbat flame and doesn't take a match and actually light the flame on time, the mitzvah wasn't done. Right? The opposite is true, actually. If someone just rushes and knows that, oh, it's Shabbat, and chaps a match quickly, didn't even think about it, and mumbles the blessing quickly and lights the candle, it's missing the intent. You should work on it for next week, but the mitzvah is done. And the mitzvah is eternal. And the candle has been elevated. And the flame has become something, it's physical, but it's become now something completely different. It's been transformed. If you take a piece of parchment, just knock on a mezuzah on a door, of course, it's good to learn about it and understand it and connect to it spiritually. But if you do that without knocking on the door, the mitzvah isn't done. When you knock it on the door, suddenly it's eternal. It's real. It's now a godly piece of parchment. Transformed, right? So that's what meaning does. And in terms of Jewish meaning, it's all about the act. It's all about the action and actually connecting to God through that mitzvah and through that physical act. Giving, helping someone else. All these things, all types of mitzvah, right? And then, of course, as he always says, and he brings in this lecture as well, it brings meaning. It brings the happiness, I mean, right? Because as we learned a couple of weeks ago, you cannot pursue happiness. If you pursue happiness, you won't find it. If you pursue meaning, happiness will come, right? And in this lecture, he says the same thing. He says, to put it more elegantly, a human being is a meaning-oriented being. And if he succeeds in finding meaning on his search, then he'll be happy. But please note, only then. For if he pursues happiness to the same degree that he does so, he simply cannot become happy because he would have no reason to be happy. You need a reason to be happy, and that reason comes from meaning. Then he says, thus, he will not only be happy if he pursues meaning, if he can perceive a meaning, but conversely, he'll also be able to cope with suffering to the same degree. That's Viktor Frankl's big thing, that if you pursue a life of meaning, you're also able to find meaning in challenge and suffering, as we talked about a couple of weeks ago. But let's take it a bit different angle. I want to share something with you, because it has to do with the concept of transience, right? See, if everything is transient, and which means also everything is random, like if the world just comes and goes, we're born and we die, it really has no meaning, right? And then suffering can't work. Because if everything is random and has no meaning, then suffering just gets in the way. Any challenge gets in the way, right? But if you give something purpose, it's a whole different story. I want to just relate it back to something I heard just a day or two ago. Because one of the things I've been noticing coming out of Israel, and I wanted to talk a little bit about that. We've talked about it before, but I've seen this week in a much more emphasized way, is the incredible surgence of Emunah. I think just unbelievable. I can't say it with everyone, but it's certainly, whether it's religious, not religious, the awareness of God and the awareness of purpose coming from that faith is just incredible. I'm sure you've seen some of these videos, you know, people in bomb shelters or in tunnels while the sirens are going off. That what do? They're dancing. There's a very, very popular song, which I don't know the whole song, but it has this thing as Od Yoter, you know, it's going to be good. It's good, and it's going to be getting more good, and it's like unbelievable, right? And God's going to save us, and there's like religious and secular, and everyone from all walks of life, they're dancing in the bomb shelters, in the tunnels that there was a video of traffic going through a tunnel and the siren went off. So they all stopped their cars and got out because the tunnel was the best place to be. One of these traffic tunnels, whatever. So what do they do? You know, when we're stuck in a tunnel, we just get frustrated. What do? They get out of the cars and they start dancing and singing. One guy standing on the roof and he's clapping, he's dancing, he's singing. It's unbelievable, right? It's unbelievable. You talk to people there, it's just unreal. I've been talking to a few people there. They're okay. It's going to be good. Yeah, they're missing a bit of sleep, they tell me, because it typically goes off during the night, so therefore they can't sleep properly. But they're just incredible, right? And then someone told me about a relative they have living in some place in Israel who are from the few that just can't connect to this Emunah. They just don't get it. Like they're not seeing it, they're not feeling it. I'm not judging, I'm just saying this is the reality. And then he tells me that as a result, they're actually very depressed. They're actually really upset. And the link to me is very obvious, right? Because if there's no Emunah, if there's no faith, which means then the world is just really a random place. Everything's just random. It's not coming from God, so it's just random. So then the world is really transient because it has no real meaning. And also, if everything is random, so then why do we have challenges? Like, what do we do with it? They're just impediments. They're just liabilities. That's all they are. So their natural outcome is to be upset, right? But when you look at it differently, when you understand that the foundation of everything is that the world without God is a transient, meaningless, empty place. But the world with God, with Emunah, suddenly changes everything because it means everything is coming from Him. He created it for a purpose. He didn't create it randomly. He didn't decide one day, no, I think creating a world would be a nice thing. Obviously, there was a purpose to it. As we said before, there was an intention to it. There was a plan. There was a mission. And therefore, nothing is random. Now again, we've said this a million times, we don't ask for challenges. But when they happen, first of all, you notice the good as well as the bad, because you're in a much safer space. We believe that God is with us every step of the way, and He's hugging us through the challenge. Why He's doing it, we don't know, but it's all from Him. And there must be a purpose, there must be a vision, there must be a goal. Otherwise it wouldn't happen. I don't know if you saw these things, but it's just amazing clips. So there's one guy who's a secular TV anchor. And he starts his program one day, I don't know who it is even, in Hebrew. And he says, I just want to say that there's been amazing miracles the last few days. And I think it's important to recognize the miracles. And we need to thank God for the miracles. And therefore he says, we need to begin the program today with Mizmor Letada. Mizmor Letada is chapter 100 in Psalms, which is the prayer of thanksgiving. Pulls out his yarmulke, puts it on his head, and that's what he does. He starts his TV show with reading Mizmor Letada. It's like amazing. Right? Then you have another guy I saw also. You know, one of the things that they, when there's, you know, in Israel there's always goes up and down. So when there's things are very normal, so they like to squabble a bit. So there's often a rift between the non-religious and the religious, you know, that kind of thing, right? So one of the things that the religious are often accused of is that they just live in Mashiach. In other words, they don't live in the real world, they don't live in the reality. They have this fantasy future that they live in, and that's where they're living, you know? So now this one guy gets also a completely not religious TV presenter with some sort of panel. I just saw a snippet of it. I didn't see the whole thing. And he says, what do you mean? He says, Atem lo yadim et Rambam? So you don't know the Rambam? You know, this is like they have knowledge there, right? So you know that the Rambam made the 13 principles of faith, right? He's saying in Hebrew. One of them is Mashiach. What do you think? Is it all for nothing? There's a goal. There's a destination. We're going to get some. Of course, I subscribe to the Mashiach camp, he says. He says, for sure. He's not. I don't know if he keeps any mitzvahs, but he says, I subscribe to the Mashiach camp. Why? Because that's the it's not just Mashiach. It's the sense of, this is all leading up to something. This is all for a purpose. God didn't just do this for nothing, right? So that's the critical thing here. That things aren't random, and that when you give meaning, everything changes, everything transforms, and everything becomes eternal, because everything has a purpose. And that's how we get through a challenge, and that's how they're getting through. But I think a lesson for us, of course, is we need to apply it to our own lives. I often say that sometimes we do things collectively really well, but we find it difficult to do in our own life. And I think the reason for that is because we do it collectively, we inspire each other. But when it comes to our own life and suddenly we hit a bump in the road, and it could be something stupid even. It could be like just a bad day or as I always say, a traffic jam or whatever the case is. Suddenly we lose ourselves, right? But it's the same principle. Nothing happens randomly. And when you take an experience, it could be an experience for half an hour, for a week, for a month, whatever the case is. Of course, we always daven for Hashem to make things good, but when they aren't so good, whether it's minor or major, that didn't happen for nothing. It's not random. And if we can take that half an hour or that hour or that week or that month and find meaning in it, strengthen our faith, do a connection, do something good, help someone else, do another mitzvah, whatever the case is, through that and because of that and strengthen ourselves in the face of challenge, suddenly that month becomes, instead of an adversary, something being really hard and negative, it becomes something that's eternal. Because we've given it meaning. And that's the point he makes all the time in his books and his writings and his talks about finding meaning even in challenge. And he made the point in another lecture, which I quoted a couple of weeks ago, that you must not look, a human being does not look for challenge. But when it happens, we have to be able to give it meaning as well. And that's his whole experiences in the camp was about finding meaning even in suffering, because nothing is random. This is the point here. Okay. The next point he goes on to make is like this. The life of meaning brings responsibility, because you own your own story and you're not a victim, right? But it also reveals potential in the person. Potential and determination. This is a very interesting point. And brings a sort of flexibility as well. What I mean by potential and being determined? So he says that when you have meaning in something, you actually reveal within yourself powers you didn't think you had, and a will to continue and not to stop and keep reaching and accomplishing that meaning. Now, from a Jewish perspective, that's very understandable, because what happens is a life of meaning is connected to our soul. A life of emptiness and pursuit of pleasure only is coming from the animal soul. The animal soul is animalistic. The life of meaning comes from our godly soul. And godly soul is an infusion of God, and God is infinite. So when we connect to our soul, we suddenly absorb a kind of, we people, we still finite people, but we absorb a spirit of infinity. What I mean by that, so he, in his lecture, he talks about a professor that he met that impressed him amazingly, and the name of the professor was Professor Burz or something, who for many years, he says, was the director of the big psychiatric institution in Vienna, the Steinhof, as it was known. The last time I saw him, Professor Burz was well over 90, and I will never forget the huge tower of reference books piled up on his desk. I've never seen anything like this with much younger colleagues. Professor Burz was 90 at the time, and I was around 40, so he was half a century ahead of me, setting an example. Then he says, please don't misunderstand me. I'm not over simplistic as I sound or I seem. I don't deny that even someone like Professor Burrs had a few defects in terms of cerebral performance. Right? But that's not actually the point. He could compensate for those defects, and with the rest of his capability, he was able to achieve far more than the average young psychiatrist or neurologist in Vienna at that time. And his point is that when you are pursuing a purpose, you don't slow down. You can keep going, and even at a very old age, that meaning doesn't change. The meaning is the same. You might have to compensate here and there, but the meaning remains. And then he says, a few years ago, I was climbing a rock face in Rex Mountains and whatever it was over there. And the guide at my time said to me, he says, don't take this the wrong way, Professor, but if I'm honest, you have no strength left at all. But you know, you make up for it with your clever climbing technique. I must say, people could really learn to climb from watching you. Right? He talks about that you don't stop and you just find ways to compensate and so on and so forth. And he says, a little bit later, he went climbing again. And he asked the guide, he says, please be honest with me, should I stop? And the guy says, no, don't stop, don't never stop. Right? That's the concept. In other words, like this. If a person defines themselves, right? I think this is such an important concept, especially as people get older and so on, or either older or situations change. See, if we define ourselves by the things that we think make us successful, or the things that we are able to get and purchase or make that can give us pleasure and so on, things that aren't meaningful, in other words, we're not living a life of meaning, then what happens is, and it fits into what we're doing and how we live life, then as soon as we can't do those things anymore, right, then we fall apart. Because, let's say someone is working, but they're working for no purpose. They're just working to be successful, to have material wealth, right? But there's no underlying purpose in there, right? We talked about it. Even a job can have purpose. Remember we talked about that time when a person was building bricks and one person was laying bricks, but the other person says, I'm building a house for God, right? Or the janitor in the hospital who knew that without him, people can't get better, so there was a purpose. In other words, what was driving him in his job is sense of purpose. If a purpose doesn't drive you, it just, what you're doing is an end in itself to just earn money or to be or to live or to have pleasure, then as soon as you can't do that, you're really in trouble. Right? But if a person lives a life of meaning, even when he's no longer able to do a particular task, the desire and the drive and the passion to achieve meaning doesn't change. And you find ways to find meaning in whatever the situation is. Whether it's a challenging situation or it's a situation of aging or inability to do whatever you used to be doing. It's a completely different perspective. You know, I remember when I was a bocher, when I was a student in 770 Eastern Parkway in the yeshiva, in the Rebbe's yeshiva, there were two older Hasidim. One of them, I forgot his name, but one of them was Rabbi Chitrik. And he was about 100 when I think he died when he was 106 or something, right? He learned like in Europe, he learned in Russia in the original town of Lubavitch. It was an interesting, a very, very great chassid. And he wasn't working anymore. I don't know what he used to do in his youth, but whatever he was doing, he wasn't doing anymore. He was retired, I suppose. But in his mind, he wasn't retired. He was just shifting to something else. Because his whole life was really filled with purpose and meaning. And he had a chavruta, a study partner, that they would meet every day. They had slowed down, not without a question. But they took their time. It wasn't a rush. And they would come to davening, and then after davening, they would sit down and they would study. He was like 100 and 101 something, and the other guy was like 96. Just parenthetically, a real funny story. They once had an argument in the learning. You know, that's how you learn the chavruta. You learn a piece of Gemara or Talmud or Hasidut, whatever you're learning, and then you try and explore it and you interpret it. And sometimes, I know, when I was when I learned with the chavruta, the same thing happens, right? No, I think the meaning is this. I think Rashi means this. They means that. So I had one of these debates once. So Rabbi Chitrik turns to this other guy and he says, you know, when you get older, you'll understand. But the point I want to bring out is that they were happy and they were driven and they had such purpose in life. Because their whole life, when there was, I don't know what they did when they were young, I don't know, I didn't know them, I wasn't around. But maybe they worked, maybe they taught, I have no idea. But I do know, judging from what they were, that whatever they were doing was with the purpose, and the Jewish purpose, to live a life that is godly. Right? And therefore, I don't know, maybe they're doing something different, but the values didn't change. See, work changes, situation changes, circumstance change, but values don't change. The values that you have don't change. Perhaps the most unbelievable example of this is a Jew who's alive. His name is Yitzi Horowitz. He was a shliach of the Rebbe. He ran a very large base Chabad somewhere in California, I think it is. And tragically, he contracted ALS. I don't know what you call it here. Is that called here? Yeah. There's different names for it somewhere. And eventually, he lost ability to do everything. And he's completely bedridden. Can't talk, can't smile, can't do anything really. He's fed with the feet. But he's been going for a number of years really like that. And nowadays, we have technology that gives a person like that the ability to communicate through eye movement. So the only thing he can do is to move his eyes. And they have a computer. And very painstakingly, he communicates and he talks. And his life was a life of teaching and inspiring others. And I think what's keeping him going is he's an amazing, amazing person. And he hasn't stopped those values for one day. And he writes a parsha column every single week. And he studies from different websites. And he inspires people who come to visit. And he is an inspiration. In other words, his life is dramatically changed on a physical level and actually hasn't changed at all. In other words, or maybe it's gotten stronger. Perhaps he's inspiring more people today than he did. Now, God forbid, no one should ever suffer. But that's just an amazing, amazing example of someone who is so determined because purpose and meaning brings infinity and brings determination. And you don't stop. Circumstances might change, but the will to keep living with meaning and to give meaning and to make the world a more meaningful place continues, right? And that's the determination. I think I'll just end with a story. I think I've told you the story once. I told it at a very very beginning of COVID, I think. Because it brings out two opposite things, but it's really important. There was two great tzaddikim, two great Hasidic rebbes. There was named Rebbe Elimelech and Rebbe Zusha. Rebbe Zusha of Anipoli and Rebbe Elimelech of Luzhensk. They were two brothers and they were very famous. They were around the Baal Shem Tov's time. They were actually the students of the Mezritcher Magid, who was a student of the Baal Shem Tov. Very, very great, holy people. And they used to go around sometimes and they used to collect money because in those times, under the evil Russian and Polish regimes, often Jews would be caught and put in jail and then there would be a very high ransom and it was like a very, very tough time. And they would often collect money to rescue these people from their imprisonment and so on, which is considered a very big mitzvah. And they would go around and they would go from town to town. One time they went and they were captured by some of the Russians and they got thrown into jail. Now the jail was like a one big room and there were terrible prisoners there. Murderers, thieves, everything, all sorts of people. And they're all stuck in this room together. And it was such a terrible place. You'll excuse me for this, but I have to tell you for the story, but the authorities had stuck a bucket in the middle of the room in case anyone needs to relieve themselves. That's how it was. So they get thrown into this room, and suddenly Rebbe Zusha looks at his brother, Rebbe Elimelech, and he sees that he's very sad. He's like, very sad. And he says, well, what's wrong? We have to serve God with joy. What's the problem? He says, you don't see? There's this thing in the middle of the room, and halachically, we're not allowed to daven. So we can't pray. That's the Jewish law. You can't daven when there's waste there, right? So Rebbe Zusha looks at his brother and he says, I don't understand you. What do you mean? The same God that said that we have to daven every day, the same God tells us that we can't daven now. So in other words, now we can serve him by not davening. Right? Interesting perspective. So Rebbe Elimelech looks at him and he says, you're right. You're right. You're 100% right. And they start to smile. And because they were Hasidic rebbes and dancing is a very big part of Hasidic lifestyle, they started to dance. Because they have a mitzvah now, not to daven, a mitzvah not to daven. And they started to dance. The story goes, interesting ending to the story. As they started to dance, there was the door flung open. They started to dance. All these Kazakhs and all these guys, they don't know. They see two rabbis. I don't know why they're dancing. But they joined in. So everyone starts to dancing. Suddenly the door flings open and the guards come in and say, "What's going on here?" So some of the Cossacks, criminals, says to the guard, "We actually have no idea. These two guys were dancing. That's got something to do with that thing in the middle, that bucket. But we have no idea what it's all about. So they're dancing. We're dancing. We're having a good time." "Ah, yeah," they said. "Okay, we'll take away that bucket now. You won't even have that." So they take it away. They look at each other. "We can daven." They start to dance again. Okay. What's the point I want to bring out of the story? The point is that the way they were actually both right. Because God gave us a formula. He gave us a code of how we achieve meaning. A code of how we treat other people, a code of how we serve Him, the mitzvot, and so on. And we all try and grow, and as best we can, each one on their own journey, we try and grow in that, and we try to add a mitzvah here, and a helping hand here, and so on and so forth. That's the default. And we have to be very determined to do it, because that's how it works. And that's why Rabbi Elimelech was upset, and correctly upset. Because when we are prevented from doing a mitzvah, we should be upset. "I want to do the mitzvah, because mitzvahs are the formula which we're given to connect with God." That's our default position. God gave us a default code. Then there's sometimes that He wants us to serve Him a little bit differently. And that's Rabbi Zusha's response. They're both correct. What's true about both of them is that the pursuit, the quest for having meaning at every moment of the day is the same. Normally, it's following the code. It's following the formula. That's what we have. The Torah we were given so many years ago. And that's what God gives us and all the opportunities that come with it. As I said, mitzvot between man and God, mitzvot between man and people, and so on. That's all part of the meaning. Sometimes God prevents us from doing it because He wants us to serve in a different way. Whatever the reason is, He knows. And that's the positional response. So they're both true. What's true about both of them is that we have to have that, when we have that passion for living a life with meaning, suddenly we get extra strength and we always want to have purpose. And whatever we're doing, whenever the circumstances change, we always find a way to give those circumstances meaning. And that's what Viktor Frankl was saying, is that when you have eternity that way and you have meaning, you're able to find it. Then you don't look at the world as a transient place anymore. It's not meaningless. In fact, the transience of the world is only a good thing. It creates a sense of urgency. And on the contrary, you have that determination, you have that potential, and you don't stop and you keep going with extra strength and extra power. Have a wonderful week.
Sorry.
Yes.
16 days to go for the raffle. I know I'm speaking to the converted here because everybody here is a huge Venice supporter.